As we've been looking in the book of Daniel, we see that God overrules and that theme develops from two opposing perspectives. One is God protecting, exalting, and using a few in a worldly environment that are faithful to Him. And then from the opposite perspective, we see God teaching and demonstrating to pagan kings that He is more powerful than they, than their armies, and their gods. The same is true today and throughout the ages, that God overrules. And we see His hand in our lives, and someday we're told in history in an overt way, He will make His rule visible and universal, and every knee will bow to Him. We're thankful for the examples in the Old Testament we can look at in enjoying going through the book of Daniel. I want you to consider tonight, where would you be if you could have everything you ever wanted? Hey, probably something we fantasized about from time to time. Think about that for a minute. Or where would you end up if you achieved everything you are currently working toward? So stop and evaluate, what am I working toward in my education? What's the goal there? What's the end goal? What's the end goal in my career path? What if all the barriers were gone tonight, what would that mean that I achieve? What position or rank? What is my goal that I'm working toward in terms of relationships or family? What is my goal when it comes to my financial accounts that I'm working toward? What is my goal for, you know, for physical fitness or for my reputation? Things that you're working toward. Okay, so imagine tonight that all of that materializes. Where does that put you? What if any relationship you wished for, you had it? What if you could name the position you want and it was yours today? What if you could say a numerical figure of wealth and suddenly that's what was in your account right now? What if you could choose to have personal servants and bodyguards at your disposal? If you could live wherever you choose in a house that's as luxurious as you decide for it to be? All right, well, you get the idea. Kind of fun to think about. Well, in Daniel chapter 5, we see two men that had everything they wanted. And those two perspectives in the book are represented here in chapter 5. Two men that had everything they ever wanted, but one valued earthly gain, the other valued God's glory. And so we have a valuable picture of what that looks like and how it turned out for each of them. The first man is named Belshazzar. Until the second half of the 19th century, you're familiar with Belshazzar, his name is the first word there of the fifth chapter. Until the second half of the 19th century, the Bible was the only preserved a record of his name or his reign. And so critical scholars suggested that he was a fictional character, that the Bible writers had invented this Belshazzar that never was the king of Babylon. But since the second half of the 19th century and through the 20th, quite a bit of information has surfaced to confirm the biblical record that Belshazzar did indeed reign in Babylon. And that, if that sounds like deja vu, that thing has happened over and over again as people have questioned the Bible and archaeology has not confirmed the biblical account, because the biblical account doesn't need confirmation from archaeology, but has aligned with and strengthened that position. Chapter 5, this is kind of an interesting thing to keep in mind. Several times it's going to refer to Belshazzar as the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Well, history's record is pretty clear that Belshazzar's father was named Nabonidus. In fact, Belshazzar is in a co-reign. He and his father, Nabonidus, rule Babylon together. Nabonidus apparently kept his distance from the capital quite a lot for religious reasons, and so Belshazzar tended to be in charge of this area where this palace is. So when the Bible says that Belshazzar was the son of Nebuchadnezzar, there are a few possibilities there. Either Belshazzar married Nebuchadnezzar's widow and adopted Belshazzar. Okay, follow, that's possible. Or Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, making Belshazzar Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. And so the Bible sometimes says, like, Jesus is the son of David, or the Israelites, even in the first century BC, would say Abraham is our father in that sense. Or it could be that the Aramaic word here used for father and son has to do with a successor. So Belshazzar is the son of Nebuchadnezzar in that he came after him in the Babylonian reign. So I'm sure you find that very interesting. I won't spend any more time there. If you're into that and want to talk more about it afterward, I actually would enjoy that. But in case you ever do hear anything critical against that, there are some good options there that are quite possible. But at any rate, extra-biblical records indicate that Belshazzar was not a nice guy, but he did have a huge empire, a powerful position, and exorbitant amounts of money, slaves, wives, concubines, and soldiers galore is the picture of our first guy. Let's read about the setting here in the first four verses of Daniel chapter 5. The Bible says, Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Okay, so here's the setting. Not a very morally praiseworthy setting where we're introduced to Belshazzar. A celebration, really, of wickedness in many ways. That might not be too dissimilar to what you see when you turn on the TV in our age and what people are celebrating and how they do that. Or maybe sounds like the setting for a rap music video or something like that, where Belshazzar is here with all his buddies, is all of his women and all of his wealth. He had everything he could ever want. Now these vessels, remember, when God gave instructions for the tabernacle, when he gave instructions for the temple, there were very strict regulations about what was allowed to be in there. And so here were these gold vessels and silver vessels that had been consecrated, sanctified, cleansed, and set apart for Yahweh worship. They were only to be used in the temple, and only they were to be used in the temple. So when Nebuchadnezzar sacks Judah and goes into the temple and finds all these gold and silver vessels, he carries them away. But it's interesting, we talked about how between chapters 3 and 4, 20 to 30 years had passed. Now again, between chapters 4 and 5, probably another 30 years has passed from the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. There was another king after him and before Belshazzar and Nabonidus. And so 50 to 60 years now, these vessels have apparently been often a treasury somewhere, because it was probably superstition that kept these Babylonian kings from using these vessels that had been sanctified to the worship of another god in their holy place. But Belshazzar is ready to cross that line. And he defiles these sacred vessels by filling them with wine to be enjoyed in his drunken party. But we get a picture of Belshazzar And here on the screen, you get kind of the profile of this first guy who had everything he wanted. In those first verses about Belshazzar, we see he had a palace. He had a position, a co-regent of the most expansive empire of his day. He had power. He could say, off with his head, or promote this guy. Remember the double-walled fortress there in Babylon that would make him feel rather secure, despite some recent advances by the Medo-Persian army. He had pals. 100 of his lords are here at this party. He had pleasures, all of his wives and concubines, whoever he wanted. And he had parties. Okay, here's a big one. A big one that he's throwing, and the alcohol is free flowing, and it starts to get to their minds and probably inhibits his judgment to say, hey, let's just go ahead and wouldn't it be fun to sip our booze out of solid gold vessels? Belshazzar even had alliteration. Let's keep reading here in chapter 5, in verse 5. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Remember in chapter 4 that Nebuchadnezzar had lifted himself up in pride, and God gave him a warning, if you don't humble yourself, you will be humbled and be made as a beast of the field. Nebuchadnezzar, after 12 months with nothing happening, stood on the roof of his palace and says, look at this great empire that I have built. The Bible says, while the words were still in his mouth, God overruled and humbled him. We could say maybe here in chapter 5, between verses 4 and 5, as Belshazzar is having his drunken party and defiling these sacred vessels, maybe while the wine was still in his mouth, here comes a hand, and I don't know if he choked on that wine or spit it out, but verse 6 says, the king's countenance was changed. Literally, his color faded, his splendor faded. He probably went from a pretty comfortable and full look to suddenly quite pale. And his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against another. His hip and knee joints lost all power, so his legs shook beneath him. Everything changed in a moment when God overruled. And Belshazzar realized quite suddenly that he had blasphemed the wrong deity, the true deity, and he's lost all of his smug arrogance as he sees this hand writing on the wall. Have you ever seen something or been in a situation that caused your legs to go weak? If so, you can relate to the fear, the angst of not knowing what's going to happen and guessing that it's not going to be good. In our house, a high percentage of the population is toddlers. And so a scary sight is to look down on the floor and see the lid of a permanent marker. Not a permanent marker, just the lid with no marker attached. And your hip and knee joints can start to lose strength. And you come around the corner and, oh no, the handwriting is on the wall. So verse 7, what does Belshazzar do? The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon. It's funny that by chapter 5, we're still calling them wise men. Because you remember in chapter 2, and then again in chapter 4, these guys come in and they're never any use. There are people that our culture considers wise people that go on TV and give advice, but it's not of lasting value. But Belshazzar, like Nebuchadnezzar, turns first to his earthly resources, turns first to his pagan resources, doesn't think to call on a man of the true God, of course. But he said in the middle of verse 7 to the wise men of Babylon, whoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet or purple and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then came all the king's wise men. But surprise, they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled. And notice again, his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. Now his color already changed once, now he's changed another shade when he finds that his wise men are no use to interpret this ominous message that's on the wall. And in this setting, that's rather degrading toward women, it's a woman who steps up. Verse 10 identifies her as the queen. Now we know that Belshazzar's wives were with him, so this character is probably the queen mother, either Belshazzar's mother or grandmother, possibly a widow or daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house. And the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. Look, Belshazzar, don't change another shade, because you'll blind us by that point. There is a man in thy kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. Whom the king, Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Apparently when the new king took over, he appointed his own people, and Daniel kind of fell back down the ranks and hadn't been needed for a few decades. For as much, verse 12, as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts, were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Here we're introduced to the second man who had everything he wanted. And if the first man is Belshazzar, let's use the Babylonian name, the second man is Belteshazzar. Very close names, but very different outlooks on life. Daniel, his name means God is my judge. And we notice some things about Daniel. None of not the palace. He apparently had lost his position, no power, only a few pals, didn't apparently have the pleasures of the parties. He wasn't invited, he wasn't around. They had to go send for Daniel. But what did Daniel have? He had the spirit of the living God. And he lived in such a pure manner that that spirit was evident to those around him, even in a godless culture. He had the spirit of God. He had giftedness from God. The Queen Mother says he has understanding, wisdom, verse 11, an excellent spirit, knowledge, interpreting of dreams, showing of hard sentences, verse 12, dissolving of doubts. We remember back in chapter 1 that these are gifts that God had given to Daniel as a reward for his faithfulness. It started with four teenagers who said, I'm not going to defile myself with these worldly substances. Four teenagers that banded together and said, we're going to stay pure in an impure culture. Four teenagers who were willing to sacrifice a lot of the fun, a lot of the pleasant things, the temporary pleasures the world offers, and go for years of sacrifice, and God rewarded that by giving them these abilities so that they could be used by Him in this land that He brought them to. So Daniel had the Spirit of God. He had giftedness from God. And third, Belteshazzar, Daniel, had a ministry for God. This is now the third time Daniel's been called upon by the most powerful king of his day to stand where all others have failed and deliver a divine message in front of a royal audience. God brought him there because of his faithfulness and gifted him for that. And Daniel faithfully used his gifts to have a ministry for God. That's a great example for us. Daniel wasn't perfect. His friends weren't perfect. We don't look to them to shape our morality after them. We look instead to Jesus Christ. But what we can see is examples of people who are faithful, who use their gifts to serve for God, and God used it in a mighty way. God wants us to be people who have His Spirit in us. He wants us to pray, Lord, fill me with Your Spirit, empty me of flesh and self in such a way that even the pagans around us could know us, hey, here's someone who's got the Spirit of God in them. It's possible. It's happened. He's spiritually gifted each believer so that we can have a ministry for Him. What happened if Daniel had not used his giftedness from God, or if Daniel had been timid and not willing to speak up for God, or had tried to compromise and dilute his message so that the kings wouldn't be offended? No, Daniel was faithful in his ministry for God, and in fact, it comes through as boldly, more boldly than almost you could imagine here in chapter 5. And in chapter 4, we saw him respectfully before the king. King, let this interpretation be for your enemies. And he was afraid to even, not afraid to tell the king. He was hesitant to hurt this man he had a relationship. But the filter apparently kind of has come off here in chapter 5. You know what I mean about the filter? Teens sometimes when they post pictures of themselves on social media, they'll edit it and put a filter on it to make themselves look better or make themselves look like a dog or whatever. And so then there's some posts that are unedited and it says hashtag no filter. So you can, oh, this is the real me coming through. Well, kids need to learn a filter with their speech and with their countenance, right? You have to have a filter, and parents try to develop that. But what you find as people get older, and older and older, sometimes that filter starts to fade away. Okay, maybe you've had a grandparent who just says whatever is on their mind, and you say, Grandpa, don't say that. The filter starts to go away. Okay, so if you've calculated, Daniel, who was a teenager in chapter 1, and as the years have passed, is now probably 80 years of age. He has no inhibitions. He's not afraid of this king at all. He's going to use this opportunity as a platform to speak boldly for God. Starting in verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, Art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought out of Jewry? Maybe he's demeaning Daniel a little bit. The queen mother says, here's a guy with great gifts and spirit. And Belshazzar says, aren't you just kind of one of those slave boys that my dad got all those years ago? But probably in his mind is the connection between those golden cups, that hand that wrote on the wall, and this spiritual man from Judah. And so he's willing to listen. Verse 14, I have heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee. You notice, by the way, they put this, they have no concept of the one true God. And that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee, that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now, if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about thy neck and shall be third ruler in the kingdom. Knowing the history, we know he offers the third position of rulership because he's a co-regent with his father. There's already two rulers, and so he's offering the best position he can, which is a great position. The purple robe demonstrates a royal role. The gold chain, likewise, would represent wealth and power. And Belshazzar is offering something that anyone else in the kingdom would have done everything in their power to get. But look at Daniel's response in verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, Let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. Daniel didn't care a bit about any of that position, about any of that power, about any of that wealth, or the pleasures that such could afford. Daniel, why? Is there anything wrong with gold? Is there anything wrong with nice clothes? Wouldn't it be cool to be in a powerful position? Daniel didn't care about it because Daniel had everything he wanted. Spirit of God, giftedness from God, and a ministry for God. You see the opposing viewpoints of these two men who had what they wanted, but wanted different things. Daniel says, I'll give the interpretation, but first, the king is going to have to listen to a little sermon. Daniel has shifted roles. He's been very respectful and subservient under Nebuchadnezzar, and will be so under the king we see in chapter 6. And it's not that he stops being respectful of the one who's his ruler. The Bible instructs wherever we find ourselves to seek the peace of that land, to pray for those in authority, to speak not evil of dignitaries. But Daniel has now shifted in his role from a subject of this king to now a prophet of God sent to give a message to this king of the doom that was about to come to him. So Daniel is now speaking as a prophet for God. Verse 18, O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive, and whom he would, he set up, and whom he would, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew. And if you've underlined this three times in chapter 4, you can mark it again here. Until he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will. A powerful message. And in verse 22, And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. Daniel's first point of contention against Belshazzar, this first accusation is, Belshazzar, you witnessed what happens when a ruler lifts himself up in pride and won't humble himself. You know that it doesn't go well. You knew this, O Belshazzar, and still you wouldn't humble yourself. And for us, we look at Belshazzar and say, yep, he should have known better. He should have known better. He was old enough, the records, if you compare enough of it, to see that he was an adult when this was happening to Nebuchadnezzar 30 or so years ago. Belshazzar knew what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, and he didn't learn from it. In young people, sometimes your parents or your pastors, you know, old people, they'll say, forgive me there. They'll say, look, you've got to learn. Don't go the way those others have gone. Even don't go the way I have gone. Look, if you take this path, it doesn't end well. And you've seen, you can look at examples of people in their lives that they've turned to alcohol. They've turned to drugs. They've turned to, you know, living for self. How did that turn out for them? If we've seen the end of that road, how foolish it is to continue down the same path until someone would have to speak into our lives and say, look, this destroys lives and you knew this, but you still wouldn't humble yourself. Verse 23, but thou hast lifted thyself up against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of the house of his house before thee, that thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver and of gold and of brass, of iron, of wood and stone, which see not, nor hear not, nor hear nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is and whose are all thy ways hast thou not glorified. Look at the boldness to say all these gods that you are toasting to, Belshazzar, they don't see or hear or know a thing. They are powerless. Only the God you've blasphemed is able to lift up and to put down. Verse 24, then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written, still Daniel speaking, and this is the writing that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, a word that means numbered. God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, Aramaic word for the shekel, or to be weighed. Shekel was a unit of weight. Thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Perez, or farsin, is the cutting in half. When you parse a word in English class, you're dividing it. A parson was a half shekel, and so they would divide a shekel in, for a unit of weight or for a unit of currency. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. So this is the message. The Belshazzar, numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. So we look back at our biography, our overview of these two men, one who by earthly standards had it all, the other who by earthly standards had very little but was rich in God's kingdom. And God comes down to evaluate. God weighs, God numbers, and God stamps the verdict on each one's life. And for Belshazzar, the final message is lacking. For Daniel, the final message is content. Daniel had everything he wanted. Belshazzar had everything he wanted, but everything Belshazzar wanted couldn't get him security, couldn't get him satisfaction, couldn't get him favor in the afterlife. Belshazzar was weighed and found wanting despite everything he had. Daniel said, your gifts be to yourself. Give your gifts to someone else. He had everything he ever wanted. He was content because of God's hand in his life. And the commander then commanded, verse 29, Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. The scene ends with the man who had it all by the earth standards face down in a pool of his own blood, while the man who had little by earthly standards but much in God's kingdom is exalted even beyond what he asked for or wished. He was a guy who sought first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and those other things were added to him. So the message for us, think back to the starting of our service where we contemplated, what am I pursuing? What if all the barriers were removed and I got what I'm after? Where would I be? And compare that finish line with these two men, Belshazzar and Belteshazzar. If getting everything you're pursuing ends you up more like Belshazzar than Belteshazzar, and you're pursuing the wrong things. Each one of us is under the watchful eye of God. Each one of us has our choices, our lifestyle, constantly scrutinized by God. He is the one who weighs. He is the one who numbers. And he is the one who metes out the judgment, because he overrules. So what does he see in your heart today? As you are weighed in the balances, whether you value what Belshazzar valued or whether you value what Belteshazzar valued, what are you pursuing? Where is your heart? Jesus warns that where your treasure is, there where your heart be also. It's interesting, Daniel wasn't interested in the king's gifts or power, his promotion or glory, because Daniel took one glance at that message and knew this kingdom's only going to last a few hours. What good is third in rank going to do me in a kingdom whose clock has run out? And so for us, living in a world that offers many pleasures, promotions, power, and positions, we can say, why would I value stuff in a kingdom that's only going to last a short time longer? I'd much rather invest in a kingdom that's eternal. Two men that got everything they ever wanted. What are you seeking first? If our primary goal is serving Him, you may never be wealthy, but you can still have everything you ever wanted if what you want is to serve God. Daniel spoke up when he had a platform, delivered a powerful message. He was filled with God's Spirit and fulfilled his ministry that God had for him there in Babylon, because Daniel wanted what God wanted. Let's ask God to change our hearts to value that which He prioritizes. Join me in prayer.